Today, I'd like to talk to you about some of the recent work I've been doing, experimental work I've been doing in the lab of Dan Bolnick and in collaboration with Deepa Agashi. So I'm just gonna try, it's gonna hold there. Maybe I'll put it in my pocket. Okay, just gonna move this here so I can see it. Okay, so under many natural circumstances, individual or organisms have or can choose their diet among a range of available resources. And theoretical work has shown or has demonstrated that this choice depends on the relative cost and benefit of these alternate resources. Under an ideal free distribution, individuals should distribute themselves across the landscape or across the habitat in such a way as to maximize fitness. If their resources are of unequal value, individuals should first preferentially use the high-value resource. But as intraspecific competition increases, equalizing the fitness benefit of the alternate resource, what you would expect is that the individuals would start including resource that were initially of less value. Now, this prediction of niche expansion has wide empirical support and can arise through or via behavioral shifts or plasticity or evolutionary adaptation. Despite the wide support for this verbal model, there's a few cases in the literature where this the model cannot explain the diet use that is observed. For example, Inman has shown that in pigeons, if you increase the intraspecific competition, what happens is that individuals actually become more selective. And so therefore, you don't see this niche expansion, but rather you see a niche compression. There are a few other examples like that in the literature, which I'm not going to get into. But this reveals something about this verbal model, that we're missing something here. There's some key process that is missing, or some assumption that this model is making that is violated. And therefore, I think that this wide acceptance that intraspecific competition necessarily drives diversification might be an oversimplification. So today, what I'd like to do is talk about the effect of population density on niche use. And so I'm going to start kind of like a bit reverse way, and I'm going to throw at you right away some explicit experimental tests and results that we got from the lab experiment that we've been doing. Then I'm going to introduce to you a simple model of optimal resource use. And then I'm going to show you how we fully parameterize this model, generated predictions, and tested these predictions. And then we tested the assumption of that model and applied modification to that initial model whenever these assumptions were violated, to basically try to come up to generate predictions that would be in line with the experimental results that I'm just going to be showing you in a few minutes. Okay, so I'm going to start with the results. And so what the model system that we're using are flower beetles, Tribolium castineum. They are really convenient to keep in the lab, short generation time. You can just keep them in small Tupperwares. They've been maintained on wheat flour for over 200 generations, so this is really considered their ancestral resource. They compete both at the larval stage and at the adult stage, and we can use stable isotope to quantify the proportion of the resource that they use in that environment. So what we offer them is the wheat ancestral resource, along with a novel resource that we know is suboptimal, the corn flour. So we know that corn flour, beetles develop slower and have also a lower survival. Okay, so how we designed the experiment is we had a range of densities, so from 20 beetles, adult beetles, up to 200 beetles. And we had two kinds of habitat. Either they were kept in wheat only, or a habitat where they had, this is kind of where they had access to wheat and corn with two adjacent patches. There's no barrier between these two patches, so the beetles are free to move from one side to the other. And so we waited 2 weeks, then removed the adults, and we estimated fitness from the per capita productivity of these adults. So basically just counting how many individuals were produced by these initial adults. And then we estimated the niche width in the adults using the isotope, so the carbon signature. And we also estimated the niche width of the larvae using preference assays. So we there's three lines of evidence that we collected to show that actually our data, or the beetles, are doing the reverse of what we would predict based on the verbal model I just outlined to you in the introduction. So here's the first line of evidence. So what you have here is the population density of our populations here, and here's the delta 13C signature, and or if you prefer, you can read it as the corn, the proportion of corn that the individual beetles used. And so what we see is the reverse. We were expecting a niche expansion with a population density, but what we see is that the populations on average use less and less corn as density increases. So then we turn to the larvae to see what they were doing, and they do the same thing. So as density increases, the larvae coming from population at high density tend to prefer the wheat patch versus the corn patch. And finally, the third line that we looked at is the oviposition of the females. And what we found is that when you go from the low-density treatment to the high-density treatment, the females increase their proportion of eggs that they lay in the wheat. So here's the corn patch, wheat patch. So that's the proportion of eggs that they lay in each patch. So when you go from low to high, the females switch the proportion of eggs and lay more eggs in the wheat patch than in the corn patch. So we have these three lines of evidence contradicting this verbal model that I explained to you in the introduction. So we decided to go back to the drawing board, I guess, and start off with like a very simple model to try to explain what is going on with this, with these beetles. So I'm going to now introduce you to a simple model of optimal resource use. And there's nothing new here. I guess it's just like the mathematical representation of the model I presented earlier. So you can imagine you have a population that has two resources that are available. And so in our case, we'll have an ancestral resource and a novel resource. And to match our case study, the novel resource is suboptimal. So to calculate the population mean fitness, you need the productivity on either resource, which is the Ri, so Ra is on the ancestral resource, Rn on the novel resource, and the proportion of the proportional use of the resource. So here I'm going to use it as P, so this is how much corn they actually, or the novel resource they include in their diet. So when there's no, when it's density independent, what you'd expect is that if Ra is greater than Rn, then all the beetles should be on the ancestral patch, right? Now, if we include density-dependent productivity into this model, what we do is we basically make the Ra a function of density and including an alpha term, which is our competition coefficient. So what we did then is we use our experimental results to fully parameterize this this model and see what kind of prediction we would come up with. And so, yeah, this is what we did. So we can use, okay, so the first thing I guess we did is that when you look at the relationship between R, so the per capita productivity over the population density, what you see is that it's actually a log linear relationship. So the first thing we did is we modified our model to reflect that. Then we use the slope and the intercept, which represent the RIs at when it's density independent, so those are the intercept. And then the slopes are the ri prime times alpha. And so we plug this in our equation, and we, with our experiment, we manipulated n, and we measured p with the isotope, and we measured w. So now we can actually look at what we would expect in terms of fitness. And so when density is at its lowest, the model predicts that the highest fitness will be when the proportion of the novel resource is going to be at zero. So again, it's a nice fit with our initial model. But as density increases, for the parameter values that we plugged in, we find that at 50, a population density of 50, individuals should start increasing the proportion of the novel resource in their diet. As a reminder, this is not what they're doing. So we decided to test some key assumption of this model to try to figure out what's going on. Of course, maybe the beetles are just don't have like an adaptive behavior. Maybe they're just doing their own thing. But given that we have three lines of evidence showing that they're doing actually the reverse of what is expected, as evolutionary biologists, we think there's something behind this. So we wanted to look a bit further. So now I'm going to present to you the different assumptions that we tested and how we modified the model to account for them. So first assumption is that it's pretty much a key assumption of our model, is that the individuals are actually competing over only two resources. They have the wheat versus the corn. One thing I didn't mention to you, and people that know a bit about Tribolium will know that, is that Tribolium are actually cannibalistic, so they eat each other. So we figured, well, maybe they're not expanding their niche onto corn. Maybe they're expanding their niche onto themselves. So we looked at that using the isotope data. And so as Travis showed us, the delta N can be used to look at the trophic level of the beetles and of their diet. So basically, this tells us what's the signature of their intake in terms of protein. So I'm not going to go into the details of that, but basically you can consider the y-axis here as an index of cannibalism. And what we see is that with density, it doesn't change. So it's not significantly different from zero. So there's no density dependence here, so not explaining our result. We were not super convinced with the delta N, so we went ahead and measured and counted eggs, and this is a pain, but we did it. So we counted the number of eggs, or inferred the number of eggs that got cannibalized at low versus high density, and again, we found no effect of density. So beetles don't seem to increase their rate of cannibalism at low versus when they move from low to high density. Okay, so this first assumption doesn't seem to be violated. Second assumption is that competition equally reduces the real and perceived value of their resources. And I guess the basic model posits that at low density, individually specialize on the high-value resource. But as the density increases, the value of the resource degrades to the point where they're going to be moving onto the novel resource. So this is true unless the rate of degradation of the novel resource is higher than the ancestral resource. So we wanted to look at this. So first of all, our empirical results here seem to suggest that this is not the case. So the real value seem of both resources, so this is the corn. I guess I didn't point this out earlier, but this is the corn and this is the wheat line, and actually their slope is not significantly different. So it seems that it degrades at the same rate. But then, so that's the real value. But what if actually the beetles perceive something else? What if corn becomes more stinky for like a certain rate of degradation? So as you can see, like we really wanted to test every single possibility. So we actually generated stinky flour, and so which we call conditioned. So basically what we do is we have flour with beetles, but the beetles cannot access the flower. So the flower just takes, is conditioned by the presence of the beetles without being used by the beetles. And then we compare that to the fresh flower. And what we see is that at high density, individuals hang out. So here on the y-axis is the proportion of the adults found on wheat versus corn. And so if you look in the condition treatment, there's about 50-50 in the percent of individuals found on the corn versus wheat. In the fresh flower, we find basically the same proportion. And then we looked at the number of eggs, again, more egg counting. And here again, there's about 40% of eggs that are laid in wheat versus corn. And this does not change. It's not significantly different if the flower is conditioned or not. So it seems that the beetles perceived the real value of the resource. So a second assumption, not violated. Okay, so third possibility. The fitness effect of using either or both resource are strictly additive in our model, which means that at low density, fitness is always maximized by specializing on the more profitable resource because RA is always bigger than RN. There's a big but up there. So if we look more closely at our empirical data, at low density, what we find is that actually individual beetles do include some corn. So there seem to be something different here. So it seems that like at low density, they're not necessarily specializing on corn, on wheat only. So we wanted to look at what is the shape of the curve at low density of the fitness curve at the low density given different proportion of corn. So empirically, this is what it looks like at low density and at high density. So on the x-axis, you have now the proportion of corn consumed. So we force feed them different proportion of corn. And then we look at their fitness. So you can see at low density, actually their fitness is maximized when they use a combination of both resource. And likewise, at high density, although it's a bit shifted. So the quadratic function or the quadratic coefficient is not significantly different from the low density and the high density. So it's simply shifted. So I'm going to go back to this. So basically, that tells us that when you're at low density, you don't maximize your fitness with a P of 0. So we modified our basic model by including this third term, which we call RAN. And this is basically a synergistic effect or interaction between these two, between the two resources. Whereas this here looks or explains what is the additive effect of using ancestral resource. That's the effect of the novel resource. This is the boost that you might get when you combine the two resources. So we can't measure RAN. So we fitted the value of RAN to match the empirical findings, so the quadratic curves that we had. And we combined that with the previous estimates that we had, and we again calculated the optimal P. And actually, I'm not going to show you the results, so they're written up there. So the revised equation helps to predict or predicts a non-zero P value when the density is very low. So this is nice. It matches our empirical results. But it does not predict the decline that we see. The niche compression is not explained by this term. So we had to keep going, and I'm almost done. So the last assumption is that there's no trade-offs between using the two resources. And so this we knew actually was not true, because we have some corn selected lines of these beetles, and we have wheat selected lines. And we know that there's trade-offs and the resource use from these two lines. So we included a new term, a gamma term here. And basically what is now this is doing, it's inflating the competition coefficient depending on how much of the other resource that the beetles are using. So if you compete, let's say, on wheat, and you're eating only wheat, there's no penalty. You're just like focusing on that resource. But if you start, if you eat, let's say, 90% wheat and you eat 10% corn, then you're penalized by, because of the use of corn, because you're not specializing on the wheat only. So basically, it means that there's some sort of trade-off. You can't do it all. You can't. So if you do just wheat, you're doing fine. But if you try to include some corn, then you get penalized for it, and you can't do well both on corn and wheat. So this is what the gamma term here does. And so here you can see what the gamma, if we focus on the left here, what the effect of gamma is on the alpha term. And basically what you can see here is that when P increases, so when the proportion of corn increases in the diet, the competition coefficient on wheat becomes stronger or harsher, if you want. So as they incorporate more corn in their diet, they're penalized for using the wheat. And the reverse is true for the corn. So think of it as like, if you're a generalist, you're going to be a worse competitor than if you're a specialist on one resource. And so we modified our model with this new term. And we can't measure, with beetles, it's impossible to measure gamma. There's a few systems where it would be possible, but we've done all this work with beetles, so we're not going to switch now. So we basically use a range of values of gamma to see what would be the effect of gamma on the fitness. And so we have, again, on the left panel, the low density, and on the right panel, the high density. On the low density, you can see gamma has barely any effect. So basically, it doesn't matter if you're a specialist or a generalist when the population density is pretty low. But at high density, gamma has a pretty important effect, I'd say. So you can see, again, when gamma A is equal to zero, we recover this niche expansion prediction that we had to start with. But as you increase the gamma value, you reach a point where actually now, like basically below a gamma value of 1.5, you reach a point where at high density, you're better off specializing on wheat only instead of like including some corn in your diet. Let's see. So I guess in more general terms, if there is a cost associated with using a resource, a given resource, while being a specialist on another resource, so being a generalist basically, then we don't necessarily expect a niche expansion as a verbal model has been suggesting previously. And so this seems to reconcile our data, our empirical finding, that as you increase, when you reach high density, the optimal P is actually around zero or at zero. So I'm going to wrap things up with some conclusion here. First of all, I just want to make the point that increased population density is not always going to lead to diversification. There are several cases in the literature, and I think it's more common than we might think, that you might see niche compression instead. Actually, if I think about it, like yesterday, Andrew Hendry talked about the different ecomorphs of the finches, and he showed us that the niche overlap decreased when the conditions were harsher, and presumably, I guess, competition was stronger. So again, we had another example here where in face of intraspecific competition, you don't have necessarily expansion of the niche. The synergistic interaction that we included in our model has the benefit of explaining why at low density you might have some benefit of using a combination of resources and not just focusing on the ancestral resource. But on its own, it cannot explain the niche compression that we see. And then finally, I guess the trade-offs, if you include a trade-off element in the model, then this can actually explain what we see here in the tribolium, but I'm sure there's many other cases where this could also be useful to determine what is going on in face of intraspecific competition. So I guess this talk was, the point here is that I want to make is that there's these different cases of increased population density with niche compression, but so far these have been left unexplained. And so what we're trying to do here is come up with all the possible scenarios that would theoretically at least provide some explanation for it. And so I think this is pretty important in, given that the, a lot of the theories of diversification and speciation simply assume to start with that increased intraspecific competition will lead to niche expansion, and this might not be always the case. Okay, so I'd like to finish to thank, by thanking two undergrads that helped me a lot in the lab, Jay Clark and Jacob Heiling. They did most of the egg counting and all the adult sorting and so on, and the members of the board.
Maybe first an observation. It's just fascinating to me that the beetles seem so aware of their own fitness and what they need to do to maximize it, that they make the right choices.
Right.
That they're aware of this trade-off.
Well, so I guess this is obviously a behavioral shift that we see. Like they have 2 weeks to make their decision. And so these beetles have been, like, not the last 200 generations where they've been kept in the lab, but like in their natural habitat. They're found in grain, like that they're associated with different grains and so on. So you'd think, I would think that there's a strong selection to make the right choice in terms of fitness when they're facing different types of resources. And their population have crazy dynamics where they have like these huge bursts in them in population size. So I think this, there might be like strong selection in terms of like making the right decision in terms of choosing the right food source. But
what I found interesting, they get in the graphite, it looks like they know to lay their eggs in the crappy habitat.
Yeah.
Presumably as an anti-cannibal adaptation.
Yep.
So is it possible that at low density, where you had a much more extreme egg laying in the corn, that while they're over there laying eggs, they're looking for other corn, they're looking for other eggs, and in the process eat corn. And then at high density, they don't go over there so much to lay eggs. And while they're there today eating corn, they're eating other people's eggs.
Other people's eggs.
And those eggs actually came from wheat, so even though they're in the corn, they're actually getting the C3 signature and not the C4 signature.
Right, yeah. Well, so we thought about that at some point. And it turns out that the adults, they move a lot. So it's not like they're... So this would be possible for, say, the larvae. The larvae also cannibalize the eggs. But the adults are all over the place. Like, if they switch, like, every second, they might be on one side or the other. And so if you look, actually, you take a snapshot of where they are, it's almost always, like, 50-50. So I don't think they're necessarily spending more time, like, laying eggs and therefore eating corn on the other side. I think they might be going on the corn side to lay eggs and then come back or something like that. I don't know. But, yeah. But, it's a good point.
Andrew, any
questions?
Yeah.
So as you were talking, I have to confess, thinking about it in the context of Darwin's Finches, as you referred to at the end, but I think that there's a slight, there's a distinction there, and that is, like, let's say you had three resources, corn, flour, and something even better. And when densities are low, everybody just uses the thing that's better. But if the abundance of that decreases, or the density of the other ones increases, then all of a sudden you have to go back and specialize on the things that you're locally adapted for. And in your system, I don't think you have two competitor species that you have to sort of interact with, one for good for corn, one for flour, and then one alternative resource that would be good for everybody.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So, I start off with that the whole population is adapted to wheat.
Right.
And, so the other resource is sub-optimal to everyone. In your case, they kind of, like, adapted.
Yes, I think the mechanism of contraction.
Yeah, that's a good point,
I've got an observation. We started out with an ideal predistribution, Steve Fretwell and so forth. So you've got habitat and you've got resources in habitat.
Mm-hmm.
You've got individuals that are moving around frequently between the two habitats. The treatment almost is that it's one habitat that's just pretty well mixed by movement. You could do another experiment
where you put a partial barrier and disperse would make it hard to move back and forth, but they occasionally can move, but they can't do it kind of as part of their regular daily foraging routine, then I think you see something much closer to the ideal frequency.
Yeah, we actually, we have some experiments that are on their way to like that.